to force her eyes open, but the lead net is still in place, and the only response she can summon her body to make is the single tear she feels sliding down her cheek.
29. Wren. Sophia and I sit under a covered arch and watch while Lizzie shoots photo after photo, moving from one spot to another quickly and efficiently, snapping, snapping, like a child in a candy store who can't grab fast enough. On the way here, she told me about the popularity of San Gimignano with photographers and how the light at sunset was supposed to be amazing. It's just after 4:30 now, and the light is every bit as beautiful as Lizzie had predicted. It's hard to explain, really, without seeing it for yourself. But it's special, and even though I'm no photographer, I can see it. Sophia is again snoozing on my knee. I rub under her chin in a methodical rhythm that elicits from her a near-purring sound. I wonder how long it will take her to finally feel rested. Lizzie stands at the top of an angled set of stairs, shooting down into the square, and then tipping her camera upward, aimed at an angle of roof and sky. Her love for what she is doing is so obvious that I feel a pang of sadness to think she spent so many years without it. I can only equate it with my music and how much a part of me it has always been. Leaving it alone would be like getting up in the morning and trying not to breathe in air. She's wearing jeans, the skinny kind, and a white tank top that scoops low in the front. Her arms are long and finely muscled the way lifelong runners tend to be. Her thick blonde hair is pulled back in a loose ponytail, the band midway down between her shoulders so that wisps of it escape around her face and cling to her cheeks. My gaze falls across her mouth, her lips full and soft as I now know them to be. And suddenly I'm thinking about last night, and the unexpectedness of wanting her in a way I've never wanted anyone before. On the surface, I'll be the first to admit that it makes little to no sense. Aside from this time together here, our lives are about as different as it is possible for two lives to be. I don't understand it, and yet I can't deny how it feels to be with her, how the weight that has sat on my chest for the past 3 years is no longer so heavy that I don't think I can ever push myself out from under it. It's still there, but something is starting to occur to me. I don't want the weight to be there anymore. And that hasn't been true since the day Colby died. I've welcomed the boulder of guilt that crushed from me even the desire to go on living. Why now? Why this woman? I came here at peace with the realization that life as I have been leading it is a life I no longer want to live. And even beyond that, deserve to live. That piece of my decision has never changed, will never change. I know I'm not the one who should be here. Continuing on with what Colby and I had built together, he's the one who should be here. Even if Lizzie has opened a door in me, let in a slip of light, of hope, none of that erases this second truth. She drops her camera to her chest, lifts a hand, and waves at us. Her smile hooks something low inside me and literally brings me to my feet, walking me across the square to where she is standing.
"You have to see,"
she says, flipping the back of the camera open and clicking through some of the images she's just taken.
"It's incredible, more than I ever imagined."
"They're beautiful, Lizzie. The setting is beautiful. But so is your interpretation." She looks up at me then, and I nearly regret the words. I see how they validate her, and I wish that it were someone else bringing this feeling alive in her. Someone who is not me. She reaches out then and presses her palm to my face. Her touch is like electricity surging through me, turning off my brain to all reason. I dip in and kiss her fully, without any attempt to hide exactly how much I want to kiss her. Her camera is pressed between the two of us. She places her other hand on it and then slides her fingers up my chest until they are at the side of my face, her touch tender in a way that breaks something inside me. I change the tone of the kiss to reflect that same tenderness. Sophia wiggles under my arm, but I'm unwilling to end this kiss any sooner than I have to. A low sound of want breaks free from Lizzie's throat. She pulls back, touches a finger to her lower lip, and then drops her head onto my chest. We say nothing. It seems pointless, Right or wrong, this thing between us is something I have no desire to continue resisting. Even if I know how wrong I am not to.
Will you let me decide what kind of guy you are?
She asks, her voice low and soft. Lizzie. But she pulls my face to hers and kisses me in a way that tells me she's already made up her mind. I only wish I could live up to her conclusion.
30. Lizzie. We find a small hotel near the walled entrance of the town. It's charming and rustic. The man at the front desk is as happy to see Sophia as he is to see us. He leads us up the stairs to the third floor where our rooms are side by side. He's carrying a pillow for Sophia and two bowls that he pilfered from the downstairs kitchen, one for water and one that he's filled with some chunks of chicken the cook allowed him to take for the puppy. Our rooms do not have an adjoining door, and by now, I am telling myself this is a good thing. We agree to meet downstairs in an hour or so. I take a shower, blow-dry my hair, and plug my camera into my laptop. I unload the pictures from this afternoon. They're even better than I had hoped they would be. I cull the one with obvious flaws, and then choose those I absolutely love, putting them into a separate file. All of the photos focus on some facet of the square, an architectural element, the skyline above. Except for one. This one I took of Ren when he was sitting under a covered arch with Sophia. He hadn't been aware of my lens, and his face is without concealment. He is looking at Sophia with already bonded affection. I find it hard to sync the man I see in front of me with the one Ren is so certain exists. Does he? And if so, why have I not seen him? People are only so good at concealing their true nature. Or at least that is what I once thought. Using Ty as an example, I guess I would be dead wrong. I actually haven't let myself think about Ty even once in the past several hours. I'm not sure that it's been deliberate. Maybe on some level, but on another, I feel like someone completely different with Ren. And I am different. Have I ever known this version of me? Someone who can live in the moment, not try to predict what will happen at the end of this trip, at the end of this week, this day? I don't think so. For dinner, I put on a flowy skirt in a shade of magenta that I've always loved, but mostly felt was too bold for any of the things I attended at home. I add a white tank top and flat sandals, lipstick in the same shade of magenta. I'm downstairs before Ren, and I wait by the front door, feeling nervous for reasons I can't exactly pinpoint. I hear him on the stairs before I see him. Butterflies assault my midsection. He's wearing jeans and a white shirt. His dark hair is still wet from the shower. I feel an undeniable urge to run my fingers through it. He meets my gaze with a smile. It's not a bold, confident smile, but has something uncertain at its edges. I'm caught off guard by it. Uncertainty is the last thing I would expect from him. "Is Sophia out for the count?" I ask, inexplicably nervous.
"Yeah, she's nearly in a coma."
I smile. "We'll have to bring her a snack." He nods, opens the door, and we step out into the cool night. The cobblestones are uneven beneath our feet.
"So where to?" he asks.
"Wanna just walk until something looks good?"
"Sure,"
he says. We turn right, heading up the incline of the street. "It's called the Town of Fine Towers," I say, glancing up at the tall structures that once represented the wealthy families who lived here. It's unsettling to think that thousands of years ago, people walked these same streets.
"I read that the Black Death killed about 2/3 of the citizens in 1300 or so,"
Ren says.
"They went from 13,000 citizens to 4,000 in something like 6 months."
"How horrible," I say.
"The town mostly stays the same," he says. "We're the ones who come and go."
We walk in silence for the next few minutes, checking out menus of little places we pass, until one in particular resonates with us both. It's small and rustic, and Ren has to duck a bit going through the door. Copper pots hang from beamed ceilings. Farm tables with wood chairs provide the seating in the room. We are greeted by a young Italian man in a dark suit, the formality contrasting with the more casual decor of the place. He leads us to a table in the middle of the restaurant. Several other tables are already occupied by diners intent on conversation and eating. We sit and study our menus in silence for a couple of minutes until it becomes awkward.
Will he follow you here?
I look up, a little startled by the question. It's the first time Ren has spoken since we sat down at the table. I honestly don't know, I say.
He seems like a persistent guy,
Ren says. I can't deny this. Winning is as much a part of Ty's genetic makeup as the DNA that contributed to his blonde hair and green eyes. I suspect that my leaving Florence the way I had was pretty much the same thing as throwing down a gauntlet of challenge as far as Ty is concerned. If he does, I say, it won't be for the right reasons. Ren takes a sip of his red wine, watches me for several steady moments before he says,
What is his reason?
Guilt? My answer is automatic and uncensored.
Because he didn't come with you in the first place?
I shake my head. No, that wouldn't have been enough to bring him all the way over here.
What then?
I want to change the subject, because I honestly don't know if I can answer him without making a bawling fool of myself. But he's watching me with his patient blue gaze, and there's something very like compassion there. And it's only then that I realize how much I need to talk about it, if for no other reason than to provide a release valve for the pressure that's been building inside me since Wynn's phone call. As it turns out, my best friend discovered the real reason Ty didn't want to come on this trip with me. Ren says nothing, just continues to wait with that steady gaze of his, as if he has all the time in the world and is willing to give it to me if that's what it takes for me to finish what I've started. It's cliché to the point of being embarrassing.
Go on,
he says. I try to. My lips actually part with the words intent to come out. Only I can't make them. And I sit there with my fork poised in midair, mute, while tears well in my eyes and glide down my cheeks. He slides his chair back, stands and walks around the table to sit next to me. He slips an arm around my shoulder and pulls me up close against him. My resistance lasts for no more than a second, and I literally crumple into him. He brushes his hand across the back of my hair. I am mortified to feel myself sobbing into his shoulder. My sobs have no sound, but my shoulders shake. I don't know how long I cry like that. It doesn't matter. He just lets me. Every once in a while, telling me in a soft voice that I'm okay, that everything will be all right. I don't know how to tell him that it really won't. That seems a little like a slap in the face of his kindness. So I settle for silence until my crying is spent, and my shoulders go still, and I am finally silent. I have no idea how I am going to make myself pull back and look him in the face. I have no choice, so I force myself to do exactly that. While I'm not sure what I expected to see in his eyes, amusement, ridicule, it's neither. It's just caring, unmasked, unhidden, and I realize that I can tell him, that I need to tell him. She's a junior partner at his firm. Very pretty. Very smart. Ren smooths the back of his hand across my cheek.
And he has no idea what he has in you?
Apparently nothing he wants anymore, I say, hoping I don't sound pitiful, because I certainly feel pitiful.
Then that makes him the fool,
Ren says.
Not you.
I drop my chin, a small laugh of disagreement escaping from my throat. Not in anyone else's eyes, I say, including my own. With one finger, he tips my chin up, forcing me to look at him.
He is the fool,
he says. I want to believe him. Down to the core of my soul, I want to believe him. Rejection does that to you. Makes you savagely thirsty for reassurance that somewhere down the road, someone might again find you appealing, once the sheen of rejection has lost its glisten. I know, however, that right now, I must positively glow with it.
I think, Lizzie, that when we betray someone like that, the way you've been betrayed, it says more about something wrong in the person doing the betraying than it does about the one being betrayed.
I hear conviction in his tone, and something else, too, that I can't quite identify. It almost sounds like remorse. And I want to ask him if he's been through the same thing, but even as the thought enters my mind, it strikes me how laughable it would be to think that anyone would cheat on Ren Sawyer.
You're brave,
he says, breaking the silence. Desperate, maybe, I say. Brave? No.
You could have caved, given in,
he says.
But you didn't.
Not this time, anyway, I say, leaning my head back against the booth. I stare up at the ceiling and sigh. This must seem incredibly mundane to you.
Lizzie, in this life, everyone has problems. They're not all the same, but it doesn't really matter what you do for a living or who you socialize with. There are still problems. And believe it or not, there have been times when I would have taken mundane and asked for the check.
I raise my head and look at him, smiling a little. Over actresses in 5-star hotel swimming pools? I ask, referencing a photo I had seen during my internet ramblings of him with a well-known actress who'd had a little too much to drink. He raises an eyebrow at me and says,
Don't believe everything you see.
She looked happy.
Let's just say the hotel wasn't.
So it was true?
Pieces of it,
he concedes.
Not the whole thing, though. That's usually how it goes.
I nod, hearing the note of acceptance in his voice.
Want to get out of here?
He asks. Yes, I answer, realizing I no longer have an appetite for any of the food left on my plate. 31. Lizzie. Outside the restaurant, a group of 6 or 7 college-age guys and girls stand waiting with expectant expressions. I realize immediately they're there for Ren.
Hey,
Ren says, dropping them a nod in a way that says he's used to this.
What's up?
A girl with long, silky blonde hair steps forward, her eyes wide with pure delight.
We were sure it was you. Oh my gosh! Would you mind if we ask for your autograph?
Ren looks at me, apology in his eyes as he says,
Sure.
The girl holds out a t-shirt and points at a spot on the back.
I can't believe this,
she says, her hands visibly shaking. Ren smiles at her, and I wonder if he has any idea what kind of effect he has on women. I know he does, but I mean, really. All the guys and girls step forward for their turn to get an item signed. Once he finishes, they begin thanking him in unison.
No problem,
Ren says, and then, nodding at the guitar case one of the guys is holding, he adds,
Wanna do a couple?
Everyone in the group looks as if they could be knocked over with a feather, their eyes wide and their nods mute. One of them pulls the guitar from the case and starts to hand it to Ren, but he says,
You know, send me a sign.
Yeah,
the guy says.
I know it.
They sit down on a nearby stone wall and he begins picking out the song, warming up a bit and then dipping into the intro. Ren starts to sing and I sit down to listen, as rapt as everyone else in the group. other people start to wander over, and it's not long before a small crowd forms. I hear the murmurings of recognition, but everyone is respectful and appreciative, and for the next hour they go from one song to another. When Rin indicates it's time to stop, they all clap and whistle. He spends another 20 minutes signing more autographs. Once he's finished, he looks at me and says, "Ready?" I nod. "That was incredible," I say.
"Thanks,"
he says, reaching for my hand. And we walk like this all the way back to the hotel, as if it is something we have the right to do. We take the stairs to our rooms. We stop in front of my door. I insert the key, but before I can turn the lock, Ren puts his hands on my shoulders and turns me to face him.
"I'm going to tell you something that I have a feeling you're not going to believe because of what you told me earlier."
My eyes lock into his, and I don't think I can make myself look away, even if the walls start to fall in around us. "What?" I ask, the word barely audible.
"There is nothing in this world I want more right now than to carry you into this room and make love to you. And not just to prove you wrong about there being something in you that would cause a man to do what your husband did."
I feel the breath catch in my throat, the protest I'm trying to form not even believable to me. He leans in then and kisses me, softly at first, as if asking permission. And when I open my mouth beneath his, the kiss becomes something completely different. It is a kiss of lust and longing so easily identifiable that even I can't deny his sincerity. And when he pulls me up against him, I know I'm right. I think how amazing it is to be held like this, kissed like this, to feel so wanted, just like that, wanted and not alone. I don't know how long we kiss this way, but it's long enough that I'm fairly sure there's a point not too far ahead where turning back isn't going to be an option. Maybe he feels this thought as it shudders through me, because he steps back, still connected to me with a hand at my waist. Breathing heavy and hard, he says,
"That's what I want to do. But that's not the right thing for you right now."
"I hate sensibility," I say, the words out before I can even think about censoring them. His smile is one that's made who knows how many girls fall in love with just that alone. Not having any knowledge of the rest of him, of how decent a man he is. And as much as I foolishly want to toss what he's just said to the wind, I know he's right. For a million reasons, he's right. Right, however, doesn't equal easy. I draw in a deep breath, force myself to turn away and finish opening the door. "Good night, Ren," I say.
"Good night, Lizzie."
And I close the door.
32. Ren. I've spent the last 15 years of my life pleasing pretty much no one but myself. I've been the kind of guy who sees something he wants and simply takes it if it's offered, regardless of who it might hurt, even people I've loved most in this world. So no one could be more shocked by what I just said to Lizzie than I am. It's not that I didn't want to spend the night in her bed, but it would have happened because she's hurting, and I would have been far more of an ass than her husband if I had taken advantage of that. I pick up Sophia from her snoozing spot on the bed and step out of my room onto the terrace that overlooks a small, very well-kept garden of boxwoods and Italian cypresses. Low lights form a perimeter around it, and I can see at the center a marble statue of a horse and rider. I wish I could say that what I did just now makes me somebody worth admiring, but it doesn't. I think the truth is, I already have to look at myself in the mirror every day and know that the man staring back at me is a man capable of betraying his own brother in the worst kind of way. I am that man, and I could spend the rest of my life making different choices, trying to be someone else, when in the end I can't erase what I did. Nothing I ever do, No matter how good, how generous, how selfless, we'll ever make up for that. We'll ever fix it. It's not fixable. I'm not fixable. And when something isn't fixable, it's just broken. Maybe that's how I deserve to live the rest of my life. The thought surprises me. I realize it's the first time in 3 years that I've thought in those terms. The truth is, I haven't been thinking of life past the moment when I finally take that bottle out of its hiding place in my shaving case. The moment when I unscrew the lid and take those pills one at a time, every single one, until I am erased from this earth. Snuffed out like an insignificant spark whose impact was more flicker than flame. Sophia whimpers and tries to nestle closer in the bend of my arm. Her eyes are closed and she's all but asleep. I think of the way she had looked under our car, cowering and shaking as if certain that her fate would not be a kind one. In all reality, it would not have been if we hadn't taken her with us. I don't know what they do to homeless dogs in Italy, but I do know what they do in American shelters when a dog isn't wanted or claimed by anyone. And just the thought of someone taking this little life makes me feel physically sick. I sit down on a chair near the railing, lean back with my legs stretched out in front of me. Sophia wiggles up my chest to lay her head on my shoulder like a newborn baby. I feel a surge of something I instantly recognize as love, pure and overwhelmingly real. At the same time, I think of Lizzie, and another tangle of emotion settles over me. Just a few days ago, I had no desire to remain on this earth. The truth is, I knew I didn't deserve to be here any longer. And I still don't if I judge myself for what I did to my own brother. In my decision-making, I had taken into account the fact there really wasn't anyone I was sad to leave behind. Only now there is. A married woman and a little white dog.
33. Lizzie. I flip onto my back and throw the covers off for at least the fifth time since I got in bed a couple of hours ago. I haven't slept. I can't sleep because all I keep thinking about is that kiss Ren left me with at the door. Somewhere along the line, I don't even know how many years ago, I started to realize that I no longer felt like an attractive woman. It wasn't something that hit me in one fell swoop of acceptance, but something that seeped into me, little by little, fueled by the fact that Ty rarely noticed my appearance, whether I had on sweatpants or a short skirt. Of course, there was also the fact that our sex life had ceased to exist. And I didn't reject the theory that I was simply no longer attractive to him. I think on some level I accepted it as one of those truths of life. That whatever had made me attractive to him in college, when we were first married, I didn't have any more. For him or for anyone. But standing outside this room, in the arms of a man I didn't even know a week ago, I wonder if maybe I was wrong. Could it be that Ren really had wanted me, and the only reason he had left was conscience? Lying here in the dark, thinking these thoughts, I have to admit that maybe I wish his conscience hadn't made itself known until the morning. But no sooner have I released the thought than I can't deny that he was right. I rub my bare wedding ring finger. Even though I've removed the ring, I'm still married. I have no right to Ren. Because despite anything he might offer me as solace to a very bruised ego, I'm still married. In actuality, I should have been the one turning him away, listening to conscience. In another phase of my life, a time when I hadn't felt so rejected, I would have. Because regardless of how Ty and I started out, the bond of marriage and the vows I made have always meant something to me. I once thought they meant something to Ty. The thought of facing him, of hashing out everything that will have to be hashed out between us, makes me feel sick. I don't want to hear his whys and his explanations and justifications for the choice he made. Ty is a lawyer. He convinces for a living. Somehow, some way, he will convince me that his choice was entirely my fault. that I'm really the one to blame for the fact that he jilted our anniversary trip in favor of a 24-year-old attorney. A rap at the door bolts me off the bed. My stomach plummets at the very same moment, and I am suddenly drenched in a confused combination of heat and cold. Has Ren changed his mind? Have I changed mine? I don't have an answer to either of those questions. But I get up and walk to the door anyway, turning the deadbolt lock, only to find that it is not Ren standing on the other side. It's Ty. I picture myself as I know I must look, eyes wide and still hazy with lustful thoughts of another man, lips parted in complete and utter surprise.
Hey,
he says, not angry, as I might have expected, but contrite. Contrite is something Ty has never done. It's as unnatural to him as accepting defeat without an all-out brawl to the death. For the life of me, I cannot speak. I try to force his name past my lips, but it won't come. It is stuck somewhere in the back of my throat behind a scream of utter outrage for the fact that he has caught me so off guard.
May I come in?
He asks, and I notice immediately how tired he looks. His white cotton shirt is uncharacteristically wrinkled and untucked from his khaki pants. No, I say. As a matter of fact, you can't. His eyes widen almost imperceptibly, and if I didn't know him so well, I might have missed it. But I do know him, and he did not expect my answer.
What do you mean, I can't come in?
He asks evenly.
I'm your husband.
The laugh leaves my throat before I realize it's even there. And it is funny, actually, the irony of it. So, you remember that? I ask, once my amusement has faded.
Let me come in, Lizzie. We need to talk.
Well, see, I don't really think we need to talk. I think I know everything I need to know. He doesn't answer right away.
Lizzie, it's not.
Yes, it is, I say. It so is. The words slip out, so revealing, so indicative of my hurt, I want to grab them back, hide my pain from him, and not give him the satisfaction of knowing what he has done to me. He reaches out and pulls me hard up against him with one arm, while anchoring his other hand in the back of my hair. He leans in and kisses me fast and furious, and the first thing that registers is, this is how he used to kiss me, before I became neutral in his eyes, before whatever he used to see in me faded away. For whatever reasons, the tables have turned, and Ty is seeking instead of rejecting. I allow this to have its effect, feeling just the smallest amount of gratification. And then I realize how much I do not want him to kiss me. I try to pull away, but he's not letting me, and I push against his chest, saying, Stop! Ty, stop!
You don't really want me to,
he says.
You want me to come in there and beg for forgiveness, and I can do that. I will do that. Let me, Lizzie,
he says, and kisses me again. This time I catch him slightly off guard. When I push him away, he stumbles back a bit and hits the corner of a table against the wall behind him. He kicks the table and then,
Damn it, Lizzie, what are you doing?
Leave, Ty. I want you to leave. I hear the chain on the door to the room next to mine. It is only then that it occurs to me we might wake up Ren. The door opens, and there he stands, shirtless, in jeans and bare feet.
Are you okay, Lizzie?
Yes, I say, my voice shaking a little. Ty looks from me to Ren, and then back at me again.
What the hell is going on here?
He starts to say something, and then stops as if the words won't come out. Finally, he manages,
Are you telling me that the two of you have been...
He breaks off and takes a step back, raking a hand through his hair and anchoring the other on his hip. He stares at us both in utter shock. It's not what you think, I say.
Then, what the hell is it?
He says, each word measured and tight, barely concealing his anger. He looks back at Ren, and I see the moment of recognition on his face. It's quickly followed by disbelief.
I'm a friend of Lizzie's, Ren says. That's who I am. And if she doesn't want you here, you need to go.
Ty shakes his head as if he has no idea where to go from there. He laughs a short laugh and looks at me, saying,
So I came over here thinking I was the bad guy, all prepared to do anything to get you to forgive me. And as it turns out, you must have been hoping I would back out of the trip.
He stares at me and then at Ren and says,
Although this makes absolutely no sense. Which part?
Ren asks, his voice low and careful.
The part where my wife has been screwing a rock star.
The punch is so quick and so sudden that I can't quite believe it's really happened, until Ty is picking himself up off the floor and coming at Ren with the look of a bull that just discovered a competitor in his pasture. He charges at Ren, knocking him into the open doorway of the room. They both stumble through, and I scream for them to stop. The room is dark, and I can barely make out who is who. But I hear punches. I also hear Sophia whimper from somewhere in a corner of the room, and now I am yelling, Stop! 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 The room goes silent. I flick on the hallway light, spot Sophia huddled by the nightstand, and run over to scoop her up. A hotel manager is now standing in the doorway, looking as if he's not sure whether to come in or run.
What is going on here?
He asks in an authoritative voice. Everything is fine, I say, just a misunderstanding. The manager looks from Ren to Ty, shakes his head and says,
Must I call the polizia?
No, no, I say, pleading in my voice. Everything is okay. I point at Ty. But this man isn't staying at the hotel. Could you please ask him to leave?
Lizzie!
Ty barks. Go, Ty. This isn't how we're going to solve anything.
I think it's pretty clear that you're not looking to solve anything with me,
Ty says.
I believe she asked you to leave,
Ren says. Ty shakes his head as if he has no idea what to make of any of it. And for a moment, I almost feel sorry for him. Maybe I do feel sorry for the old Ty. Just not for the new one. He turns abruptly and walks out of the room, slamming the door shut behind him. The strip of moon through the balcony door is the only light left. Even so, I can feel Ren's gaze on me. Sophia wiggles in my arms. I reach out and hand her to him.
Are you okay?
He asks, his voice quiet and soft. I nod. I should be asking you. He rubs his palm across the left side of his face.
He's got a decent right hook. I'll give him that.
I'm so sorry to have dragged you into this, I say, mortification beginning to set in. He shrugs.
Don't be.
A large red circle is beginning to imprint on his left cheek. I reach out and touch it with one finger, then quickly pull back as if the touch has just burned me. That's going to hurt. Do you want me to get some ice?
No, it'll be fine. I've had worse, believe me.
I wouldn't have taken you for the brawling type. He smiles.
I usually try avoidance as a tactic whenever possible. Saves the knuckles.
We study each other for a moment. At least a dozen things I should probably say cross my mind. I reject each one of them, though under the painful awareness that what has just happened will change things. I can no longer go gallivanting all over Tuscany, pretending that I don't have a situation in my life that needs resolving. Clearly it does, and no one else can do that for me. Not Wynne by giving me a heads up, or Ren by coming to my defense with his fists. Tomorrow I will face the music as I already should have done. If I had, none of this would have happened tonight. All I want to do now is sleep and hope that when I wake up tomorrow, things will look a little better than they do now. I'm not sure how that will happen, considering where things stand at this moment, but I guess I can hope. If you're sure you're okay, I think I'm going to bed.
Okay,
he says. I take a step back and start to turn toward my door when he says,
Lizzie?
I turn back. Yes?
Are you sure you're all right?
He asks. I can't deny the concern in his voice, and I wish I could wrap myself up in it like a cocoon of comfort. But I just say, I'm good. See you in the morning, okay?
Good night, Lizzie,
he says, and with obvious reluctance, leaves.
34. Kylie comes awake abruptly. Her eyes fly open, and she instantly flashes to the last thing she remembers, a hand with some kind of cloth covering her face, a smell that she fights but fails to push away. She could only breathe it in, and then nothing. Until now. She tries to scoot up, but finds that her hands are locked behind her back, chained to something. A bed rail. She yanks at it, feels her shoulders scream in protest. She cries out in frustration, looking around in panic at her surroundings. The floor is some kind of yellowed linoleum. Black paper has been stapled to the windows, and the only light is what seeps in around the seams.
Hey, are you awake?
The girl's voice makes Kylie scream. Only her scream is muffled by the tape across her mouth. She makes a sound to indicate yes.
Good. I've been trying to wake you up for hours.
Kylie tries to ask where she is, but the sounds behind the tape do not come out as words.
Don't try to talk. They won't take off the tape until you quit trying to scream. I'm over here, on the other side of the bed. I've been here 3 days, and I'm sorry that you're here too, but I've never been so glad to see another human being as I was to see you.
Kylie tries to scream. Why?
They haven't done anything to me yet. I think they're planning to take us somewhere. I overheard one of them say they needed 2 more after me, so I guess we'll be waiting until they get another one.
Another one? Kylie hears herself being described as a thing, and she is suddenly so filled with rage that she starts to buck against the chain holding her hands prisoner. This can't be happening. This cannot be happening.
You'll just hurt yourself, the girl says, her words underlined with the acceptance of defeat. I've tried all of it. You won't get loose.
But Kylie isn't a quitter. She twists and pulls until her joints scream in protest, and she is sobbing behind the tape. Her efforts do not go unnoticed. A key sounds in the lock of the door across from the bed. A large man walks in, holding a rag in his hand. Kylie looks at his face and realizes he's wearing a mask, the face of an old man with stringy gray hair. She starts to sob, but the cries stall in her throat. The rag covers her nose and she tries to hold her breath, but the man is patient and waits until she can no longer refuse. She breathes in with the panic of suffocation, and everything around her falls away.
35. Lizzie. I open my eyes to pounding. At first, I think it's a hammer, but as my grogginess starts to lift, I realize someone is knocking at my door.
Signora Harper.
I throw my legs over the side of the bed, stand and walk in a not-so-steady path to the door. I look through the peephole and see the manager from last night wearing a very worried look on his face. I open the door just far enough to peer out and say,
Yes? I am very sorry to disturb you, signora, but I have had a phone call this morning, a most troubling phone call.
What is it? I ask, suddenly worried.
The Polizia are asking about the incident last evening.
For a moment, I have to wonder what incident, and then the memory of what had happened in the hallway between Ty and Ren washes over me. And right behind it, a sweep of anxiety. What did they want?
It would seem Signor Harper is filing charges against Signor Sawyer.
What? The question comes out on a gasp of disbelief.
Si, si. I thought you might want to know. The Polizia are on their way just now.
Now?
Si. I did not know if you might wish to leave.
He lifts his shoulders in a shrug.
If you would like to go, I will tell them I am not aware of your leaving.
My mind is suddenly so full of anger at Ty that I can barely force myself to speak. You are very kind. I will speak to Signor Sawyer. But what about our bill? I ask, shaking my head.
Is fine, he says. Come again another time.
But we can't possibly...
You should leave, Signora, he says in a more serious tone. I feel the paparazzi will be not far behind the Polizia.
I realize then that he is fully aware of who Ren is, and this act of kindness is one I shouldn't question. Thank you, I say, grateful. Thank you so much. I close the door, grab a pair of jeans and a t-shirt, and yank them on as fast as I have ever gotten dressed in my life. I slip on sandals, toss the rest of my belongings in my open suitcase, pack up my laptop and camera, and drag them quickly out the door. At Ren's room, I rap quickly and sharply and call his name a few times before he comes to the door, looking ridiculously appealing, considering that I have just woken him up.
Hey,
he says, running a hand through his dark, wavy hair. I think we have to go. He raises his eyebrows and says,
What do you mean, have to go?
The manager just came up to warn me that the police have called. Ty has apparently filed charges against you. He suggested we go. Ren stares at me for several long seconds as if he's not sure what to say.
I don't generally run from guys like Ty, he says carefully. And he threw the first punch.
Do you want to stay and explain that to them?
We can, he shrugs. I'm good either way.
But I see the awareness on his face of exactly what being questioned by the Italian police will mean for him. A scene he would no doubt rather avoid. Press he would no doubt rather avoid. Let's go, I say.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Can you get Sophia? I'll grab my things.
I leave my bag in the hallway, step into the room, and walk to the bed where the tiny dog is curled up on a pillow. She had apparently been asleep next to Ren. I wait with her in the hallway, and it's 90 seconds or less before Ren comes out and closes the door behind him.
We should go by the front desk and settle up, he says.
I don't think there's time, and the manager was kind enough to say it would be okay to go. He said the paparazzi would not be far behind. I see the gratitude on his face as he nods and says,
Okay, let's get out of here.
He grabs my suitcase, and I tuck Sophia under my arm. We take the stairs, and when we reach the bottom, I say, It would seem we're making a habit of this.
It would seem, he says.
We all but sprint to the car, and this time he says,
I'll drive.
I hand him the keys and get in the passenger side. Sophia is trying to wriggle out of my arms, and I suspect that she has to go potty.
We'll stop a few miles from here,
Ren says, throwing the car into gear. We take the road behind the hotel. It's steep and winding and narrow enough that I'm hoping we don't meet another car. Luckily, we don't. When we hit the paved road, Ren winds out the Fiat's small engine. Neither one of us says anything for the next 10 minutes. The sun is just starting to come up as he pulls onto a gravel turnoff and eases the car into the grass at the edge of the road. We both get out and let Sophia take care of business. Within 2 minutes, we're back in the car driving. We say nothing, but my mind is racing to find a solution to fix this. Ren's face is solemn and serious in a way I don't think I've seen in him so far. The realization prompts me to say, "Why don't we go back? Surely they will understand once we explain." But he stops me with,
"I need to make a call. It won't take very long."
He finds another place to turn and pulls far enough off the main road that we won't be seen by anyone driving by. He gets out and walks a short way from the car, pulling his phone from his pocket and tapping the screen. He's pacing while he waits, the phone to his ear. He starts to talk, although I can't understand what he's saying. It's brief. He gets back in the car and we drive off again. "Is everything all right?" I ask.
"That was my manager. He's looking for somewhere out of the way where we can go for a bit. He'll call back in a few minutes."
I start to say something, but realize that I have no idea what to say. I'm beginning to realize that we might both be in a lot of trouble. "Let me just call Ty," I say. "I can smooth this out." He glances at me and says,
"How?"
"By telling him I'll come home." And even as the words come out, I feel this incredible weight of sadness settle around me. It's what I need to do anyway. At some point I'll have to face the music. It might as well be now. He looks at me, one hand on the steering wheel.
"That might be, but not like this."
I start to argue, but I can't seem to force the words past my lips. The thought of leaving this incredible place, of never seeing Ren again, makes me feel as if I can't get a full breath. I know I should argue and do exactly what I just suggested, but I don't want to. And so I press my lips together and stare out the window at the Italian countryside rolling by. Several minutes pass before Ren's phone rings. He picks it up, swipes the screen.
"Hey."
He listens for a few moments and then says,
"Can you text me the address?"
"Okay," he adds.
"Thanks, Stuart. I'll be in touch."
He ends the call and glances at me.
"There's a place a couple of hours away from where we are now.
He hesitates.
"Manager says we won't be found there."
"Ah," I say, nodding as if I understand a world where I could make a single phone call and have someone arrange an out-of-the-way place in another country where I could have complete privacy.
"You're good with it?"
he asks. I nod. Even though every part of me is questioning whether we should just go back and fix this mess before it gets completely out of control. His phone dings, indicating the text has arrived. He opens it, glances at the address, and then asks me to type it into his GPS. I do, even though my fingers are shaking, and I wonder how this can possibly be a good idea. We arrive at the turnoff almost 2 hours later. Sophia stands with her tiny front paws on my window ledge looking out, her little tail wagging. Ren looks at her with a half-smile.
"At least one of us is happy about this."
We follow the gravel road for at least a mile. It's narrow and winding and covered in places with small brown pea gravel, bare in others. The road dips and turns, and suddenly a very large Tuscan villa comes into view. "What is the name of the hotel?" I ask. Without looking at me, Ren says,
"It's actually a private home. It's been available for rent. Stuart says it's for sale, so actually there's no one here."
My hesitation must be transparent because he instantly says,
"Bad idea?"
For so many reasons, I think, and then quickly regain traction with, "It's beautiful," I say.
"I'll put you on one end and me on the other,"
he offers as if he has read my thoughts. From any stance of common sense, it is the only plan I should even think of agreeing to. Why then the wave of disappointment? The villa sits in a scoop of valley, gentle hills rolling out from each side. It is old and extremely well kept. The walls are that beautiful Tuscan gold color, the roof terracotta tile. Enormous Italian cypress trees grace the front and corners of the villa. It looks like a place where a Medici might have lived, I say. How did your manager find this in such a short amount of time?
That's what he does. He takes care of things, and he's really good at it.
Apparently, I say.
And two, Ren says, he had the added motivation of wanting to keep me out of trouble. I suspect he knew that's where I was headed.
Is that a regular occurrence? I ask.
Not nearly as often as it used to be,
he says, a half smile on his ridiculously beautiful mouth. He pulls the Fiat to a stop in the circular driveway, stopping just short of the museum-sized front door.
The caretaker is supposed to meet us here,
he says. We get out of the car, Sophia wide-eyed in my arms. I think she's as awed by the place as I am. Just then a man with graying hair and a welcoming smile appears from one side of the villa.
Buongiorno,
he says, lifting a hand in welcome.
You are Signor Sawyer.
Yes,
Ren says, stepping forward to shake the man's hand.
I am Antonio. I will be happy to escort you in and show you the place.
Thank you. That would be great,
Ren says. Antonio opens the door for us, then steps aside and lets us precede him into the foyer of the house. All words leave me. The walls are fresco scenes of Italian life in times past. There's one of the sea on our right, and to our left a sprawling vineyard. A travertine staircase winds from this floor to the next. The ceilings are 15 feet by my best guess, and it's hard to believe this is a private residence.
We will cover the basics, no?
Says Antonio. Ren nods.
Sure, after you.
We follow him down a long hall to the kitchen area.
The most important, yes,
says Antonio. I smile and say, it would be for me if I could cook the way you cook in Italy.
Ah, it is practice and the right ingredients,
Antonio says modestly.
Fresh, of course, and local.
The kitchen is a charming mixture of the past and the present. Stone countertops and terracotta tile flooring are smoothly worn with centuries of use. In direct contrast, a gleaming Viking stove that might be featured in a 5-star restaurant takes up half of one wall. Copper pots hang from a rack above, some big enough to feed dozens. A wine refrigerator sits next to a stainless steel Viking refrigerator, again, big enough to be used in the most professional of restaurants. He leads us out of the kitchen onto an expansive terrace with stone walls and a covered summer kitchen. A pool stretches out from the right corner, turquoise and inviting.
"Is very nice this time of year,"
Antonio says, pointing at it.
"And not to worry. Your privacy is complete."
Heat strikes my cheeks as soon as the words have left his mouth, and I cannot bring myself to look at Ren. Sophia is begging to be put down, so I set her on the stone floor, a handy excuse to avoid Ren's amused gaze. Sophia yips and trots off ahead of us, inspecting as she goes.
"I will show you upstairs now," Antonio says.
We follow him back through the kitchen and down the corridor to the stairs at the front of the villa. At the top, Sophia races by us, stopping to see which way Antonio will go. When he turns right, she zips ahead again down the long hallway, the walls of which feature paintings of scenic Tuscan hills and vineyards and olive groves. We pass at least 6 doors that I assume are bedrooms, finally arriving at one where Antonio stops. He turns the knob and opens the door to the bedroom, which is actually a suite of rooms, A living area to the left is complete with a large screen TV and four comfy red sofas. Farther in, glass-paned doors open to a bedroom, the center of which holds a giant king-size bed with an oversized carved walnut headboard. Sophia attempts a leap but manages to hit only halfway up. She lands on her back